From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Nigerian activists step up their campaign for democracy. We'll speak with Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka, who has a death sentence hanging over his head, and Hafsat Abiola, whose mother was gunned down for speaking out against the regime. And a bombing in Northern Ireland as peace talks begin. We'll be joined by a British Labour parliamentarian and Irish human rights activist Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton has defied organized labor and liberals within his own party as he formally asked Congress yesterday for authority to negotiate new trade accords, including an expansion of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The president rejected labor's demands that he insist on extensive protections for worker rights and the environment in future trade deals. Congressional liberals have blasted the proposal, and the AFL-CIO announced an all-out campaign against it, reflecting the fissures within the Democratic Party that the administration's trade initiative is threatening to deepen. House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt called the proposal unacceptable, asserting that, quote, it sends the wrong signal to the world community about what our priorities and standards in trade should be. Attorney General Janet Reno has ordered a major shakeup and expansion of the task force investigating allegations of illegal fundraising during last year's elections, this according to the Justice Department. A veteran prosecutor and a senior FBI supervisor will be brought in to take command of the investigation, and attorneys and investigators will be added to the current staff of 90 people to accelerate and intensify the wide-ranging inquiry. The personnel changes mark an unusual mid-course correction in the management of what is widely considered the most complex and sensitive investigation handled by the Justice Department in recent years. The new assignments come after increasingly harsh criticism of Reno's leadership by Republicans in Congress. The House Committee investigating campaign finance abuses abruptly canceled this week's scheduled hearings yesterday after three prospective witnesses refused to testify unless the panel granted them immunity from criminal prosecution. Investigators scheduled the hearing after interviewing the witnesses during the last month without lawyers present, but the witnesses backed out once they obtained legal advice. Asking for immunity before the witnesses testified was a no-brainer, said Charles Stevens, a Sacramento attorney for two of the witnesses. The cancellation is an unexpected setback for Congressmember Dan Burton, the Republican of Indiana, who chairs the Government Reform and Oversight Committee. House Democrats and the Clinton White House have repeatedly questioned Burton's credibility and expertise to lead the investigative panel. Announcing his long-awaited verdict on a proposed settlement with the tobacco industry, President Clinton will endorse an agreement but insists that it include sharply increased penalties on cigarette makers if they don't meet targets for reducing youth smoking over the next decade. If all the penalties were imposed, Clinton's plan would increase the per-pack cost of cigarettes by as much as $1.50, more than double the estimated increase under the plan unveiled in June by the tobacco industry and a coalition of state attorneys general and others suing the industry. Clinton's action today, aides say, will make it clear the proposed settlement must be vastly different from the one currently on the table. In an Oval Office statement, he'll broadly endorse a plan with a combination of tougher penalties and higher payments from the industry, and as previously announced, guarantees of broad power for the Food and Drug Administration to regulate nicotine. The number of AIDS cases among women is rising more quickly than among men, and sex with infected men has overtaken drug use as the leading cause of infection among women. From 1991 through 1995, the number of women diagnosed with AIDS increased by 63% versus 12.8% for men. By the end of 1995, 67,400 women nationwide have been diagnosed as having AIDS since the epidemic began, with 11,500 of them being diagnosed in 1995. This news from Tokyo, more than 16,000 handicapped Japanese women were involuntarily sterilized with government approval from 1949 to 1995. But the government does not plan to apologize, offer compensation to the victims or their families, or conduct an investigation. The admission came one day after 17 citizens groups that represent women or the handicapped demanded that the Health and Welfare Ministry investigate cases of involuntary sterilization. Over the years, a few Japanese women have claimed they were sterilized without their consent while housed in public institutions for the handicapped or retarded. This news from this country, doctors wrote 12 million antibiotic prescriptions in a single year for colds, bronchitis, and other respiratory infections against which the drugs are almost always useless. Such indiscriminate use of antibiotics has contributed to the emergence of drug-resistant bacteria, a growing problem in the United States. More than 90% of upper respiratory infections are caused by a virus and therefore impervious to antibiotics. That's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Activists across the country are stepping up their fight against the Nigerian government of General Sani Abacha. Following a call by the 1,000-member U.S. Conference of Mayors earlier in the summer for a swift restoration of human rights and democracy in the West African country, Africa's most populous country, across this country, in cities like Berkeley, they've adopted resolutions against the Nigerian regime. This week in Washington, D.C., Nigerian democracy activists lobby Congress members, and today in New York, the city council is holding hearings on a bid to rename the street where the Nigerian consulate is located after Kudirat Abiola. She was gunned down in the streets of Lagos 2 years ago as she stepped up her campaign for the release of her husband, Mashood Abiola, who was imprisoned by General Sani Abacha after it is believed he won the presidential elections of 1993. Joining us right now to talk about what's going on in Nigeria and about the efforts here in this country is Wole Soyinka. He is Nigeria's Nobel laureate. He joins us from Washington, D.C., where he'll be delivering the keynote address at the Chico Mendez Awards presented by the Sierra Club. He then heads later today to New York for the city council hearings. We're also joined in our New York studio by Emmanuel Agbayir, who is Chief Information Officer of the Nigerian Information Service with the Nigerian Consulate. It's called Nigeria House in New York City. Well, first of all, let's begin with Wole Soyinka in Washington, D.C. Can you tell us about the latest efforts in this country, these stepped-up efforts to campaign for democracy in Nigeria?
Well, let me begin by saying that it hasn't been a one-sided effort. It's partly in response to the stepped-up multi-million dollar stepped up effort by Abacha and his spokespeople to present a very false picture of the situation in Nigeria, to pretend that something they call the Transition to Democracy program is on course, and that in fact it's just a few disgruntled people who oppose what Abacha calls a democratic program. So all over the landmass of the United States, in Europe and in Africa in particular, various democratic branches have been stepping up their efforts.
And can you talk about what's going to happen today in New York City?
Well, we are going to speak to the New York Municipal Council and let them know that we consider it unspeakable depths of depravity for anybody to pursue a victim even across the grave when her memory is about to be honored. In my part of the world, we consider it an abomination. It's unheard of. The people who are doing this, those who represent Abacha's government, are despicable, despicable cowards. There's no other expression for it. This woman is dead. She was butchered. She was valiant. She exists. She has operated in the tradition of the Sojourner Truths of the world. And this is something which people in this country respect, and they should be left severely alone to honor the memory of this woman.
Well, Soyinka, can you tell us exactly what she was doing?
I beg your pardon,
can you tell us exactly what Kudirat Abiola was doing before she was gunned down in Lagos?
Yes, she was successfully mobilizing the Nigerian women in the cause of her husband and of democracy. She's not the general picture of the repressed, suppressed, stay-at-home woman. No, no, she was a companion to her husband, and she was a colleague to many of us, myself included. I knew her personally. She was a fighter, and she was mobilizing the women, and that's what Abacha and his cohorts were afraid of, because the women constitute a very strong force in Nigeria and in parts of Africa. And this is what they were afraid of. She supported her husband's campaign. She mobilized the women from all corners of Nigeria. She speaks many languages. She spoke many languages, by the way. And she got them to come to Abuja. And the very sight of these supporters, organized by Kudirat Abiola, terrified Abacha and his people. That's why they had to kill her.
We're also joined, in addition to Wole Soyinka, in our Washington studio by Emmanuel Akpagir, who is with the Nigerian Information Service, Chief Information Officer at the Nigerian Consulate in New York. Your response to Mr. Soyinka.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say a good day to our listeners. I've had Mr. Soyinka's claims. All I want to say is that probably we should start from the beginning. And when I say beginning, that is when this problem came about. Now, after the elections of 1993, which were in any case a nullity because there were court orders which first of all stopped the elections, and then subsequently there was another court order which stopped the declaration of the results. Now, there was an interim government that came on board after General Babangida, who annulled that election, stepped aside. The interim government was handicapped. It was headed by a Kingsman of Chief MKO Abiola, as well as where Soyinka is from that same part of the country too. Was handicapped because of the various problems that were being created by his own Kingsman. Now, General Abacha was called upon by this same group of people to take over power and then save the situation, save the country from disintegration. And when he took over power, I do remember very well that the various groups, even including Chief Akbiola himself, warmly congratulated him. Not only that, went ahead and nominated people to serve in his cabinet. Now, when you consider all these things, and then suddenly there was this sudden volte-face by the same people who now say, power should be handed over to Chief Akbiola, when the elections for which they were clamoring for were inconclusive, were a nullity. So, I mean, I thought we believed in the rule of law. And if we believed in the rule of law, then everything should be done according to the rules of law.
Wole Soyinka.
Yes, can I take this opportunity to explode a certain tremendous lie which has been propagated by Abacha's spokespeople? I wish to say before the whole world, before all listeners, that I, Wole Soyinka, have never in my life called on Abacha to take over the reins of government. Neither on the radio, neither by pamphlet, neither in the media. On the contrary, I wrote a scathing commentary on Abacha's action. And I warned the people of Nigeria. It's there in the Nigerian papers. And I warned, in fact, people thought I was going to be killed because of that article. I warned the Nigerians that this Abacha is a butcher. He's a well-known butcher. His career is one of cowardly killing. And I said, and I try to quote my words exactly, I said, this man will torture, he will kidnap, he will take hostages, he will bribe, he will do anything. He will dehumanize Nigerians in order to hang on to power. That's number one. Number two, I will concede, by the way, to the information officer, yes, that there were some democracy workers and politicians who were naive and short-sighted enough to call on the most senior serving officer, who happened to be Abacha, to terminate the illegal existence of the interim government of Soyinka and hand over power. Now, that's what the councillor does not say. They call him to take over and hand over power to the winner of the election, not to entrench himself in power. But despite that, I still say they were a bit naive in doing that. But the core of the democracy movement insisted that the winner of the June 12, 1993 elections should be installed immediately. One more point. Whether Soyinka, the interim man, is my kinsman or not, I don't see what relevance that has to do with it. If my own brother, my own blood brother, is installed illegally and undemocratically, I will fight him. So that he comes from my hometown is absolutely irrelevant, and that kind of distraction should just be dismissed out of hand.
Well, let's turn back to Emmanuel Agbagir with the Nigerian consulate in New York. Let me ask you about the efforts to rename the street on which you are after Kudirat Abiola. Why have you been opposing that, and why will you speak out today at the New York City Council hearings?
Yeah, first of all, the decision to do that is preposterous. I mean, we cannot find any reason for such an honor. Now, it is simply this. Kudirat Abiola was fighting a personal stroke family cause. Now, what she was essentially fighting was, well, probably for the release of her husband from detention and possibly for him to be declared president, even in elections that were nullity, so that she could become first lady. In any case, people quite forget, people like Soyinka and the rest, forget that there was a raging family feud within the Abiola stronghold, particularly over his legal representation at the treasonable felony trial. Now, the dispute pitched his children from the first wife, late Simbiat, and Kudirat, and other family members. Now, it was so intense.
And one of those family members has just walked in the studio. We'll
it was so intense that these people will meet in court and not even say hello to each other. Now, well, under such circumstances, it was easy for anybody to have done what they did to her. Well, may her soul rest in peace. Nobody wishes anybody dead. But, you know, it was easy for anybody to have done what they did to her, and just by way of a campaign of disinformation against the government. I mean, they conveniently forget this issue.
So you're suggesting now, it was a plot against the Nigerian government to kill Kudirat Abiola?
Yeah, possibly within the family, because the feud was intense. It was intense. Abiola had many wives. He had many children from different women. And, of course, this was a bitter family feud. I said they were not even greeting each other. They were not on speaking terms.
Well, Mr. Emmanuel Agbagir, from the Nigerian consulate, we've been joined by Hafsat Abiola, who is one of the daughters of Kudirat Abiola. In fact, she has founded in this country the Kudirat Institute for Nigerian Democracy, known as KIND. You've just heard what the chief information officer from the Nigerian consulate has to say. What about that, the possibility your mother was killed by someone within your own family?
The Nigerian military, following my mother's death, suggested that she was killed by thieves. That was the initial suggestion. But my mother had been driven in a Mercedes-Benz to the Canadian embassy. The car was not stolen. Indeed, the car was riddled with bullets. None of my mother's jewelry or money that was with her was taken. And the bullet that was used to kill my mother is a special bullet that dissolves on impact with its victim, and it's only available to governments. This, in essence, identified the Nigerian military as the assassins of my mother. The Nigerian military, finding that they couldn't really sell this explanation of thieves having killed my mother because nothing was stolen, then came up with the idea that my mother had been killed by my family members. It is true that there was a feud within my family as to how to best conduct the legal process to get my father released from jail. My mother took the position that this was really not a legal matter. Under an authoritarian system, the constitution is abrogated. The only law, the final law in the country is the military head of state. That the military head of state was the person stalling my father's release from jail, not anything to do with the capacity or the qualifications of the lawyer. So this was our position, whereas some of my family members believed otherwise. But following my mother's, before my mother was killed, actually, just a week before she was killed, the family members had a meeting. And my mother said, okay, that she was turning over the case to the other members so that they could try their own lawyer. The issue was essentially resolved before her death. My home had been bugged since my father's incarceration, especially because of my mother's political activities. It is our belief that the government knew that the matter was about to be publicly announced, that the matter of the dispute between the within the family was about to be resolved, and thought that then they would lose the opportunity to send a message not only to my mother, but to all other vocal political activists within the country, and seized that opportunity to kill her, and so that they could blame my family for it.
We're going to have to break, and then we'll get a response from the Nigerian government. Hafsat Abiola, daughter of Kudirat and Mashood Abiola, is with us in New York. She is here because of the New York City Council hearings this afternoon over the controversy over whether to name the street in which the Nigerian consulate sits after her mother, who was gunned down 2 years ago in Lagos. We're joined in Washington by Wole Soyinka, Nigeria's Nobel laureate, he is in Washington because he'll be giving a keynote address at a Sierra Club Awards ceremony. And finally, we're joined by Emmanuel Agbegir, who is the Chief Information Officer with Nigerian Information Service, which is part of Nigeria House, the Nigerian consulate. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with all of our guests in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about politics in Nigeria and also politics here in this country as cities around the country are beginning to deal with the Nigerian regime through various resolutions. One of those efforts is happening in New York today in the City Council, where a decision is being made whether to name the street in which the Nigerian consulate sits Kudirat Street, Kudirat being the woman in Nigeria who was gunned down 2 years ago fighting for her husband's release, Mashood Abiola. Our guests, Hafsat Abiola, their daughter, who is here in this country, who has founded the Kudirat Institute for Nigerian Democracy. Wole Soyinka joins us from Washington. He is the Nobel laureate of Nigeria. And Emmanuel Agbeji is with us, chief information officer of the Nigerian consulate here. You wanted to respond to what Hafsat had to say.
Yeah, I was still talking on the issue of renaming of the corner of 44th Street. Now, what I wanted to say was I do not exactly know what the achievements of Kudirat Abiola are to warrant such an action. Now, it's like you're trying to compare her to people like Mandela, Rabin, who are world-class leaders and who at least have something to show for fighting for the cause of humanity, not only in their country but worldwide. Now, well, like I said in the beginning, this was a purely family affair. Kudirat Abiola was fighting a family situation because her husband is involved. So how do you now use that as a basis for which to think she is such a martyr that has to have a street renamed after her?
Can I ask something? Why is Mashood Abiola in prison, the man who ran for president?
Yeah, because he committed treasonable felony by declaring himself president. You cannot have two presidents in one country. So it is a legal matter. Now, this whole legal process was stalled by the same family. It was his lawyer who kept on requesting one thing after the other. You know, first when the issue is the judge, first they questioned the integrity of the first judge, so they had to replace him with another judge. Then they now said, oh, there was this problem, so they had to go on appeal. So it was their lawyer who kept on stalling the process of having him released. And even at a stage when bail was secured for him, it was still his lawyer who created the problem that has resulted in him still being incarcerated. It is a legal matter. It has nothing to do with the government. The
so
government
it's cannot just Mashood Abiola's own fault.
It did. I mean, it is own fault and the family's fault. Now, well, she said the.
Let me give Wole Soyinka a chance to respond, especially because he's going to have to leave in a few minutes to go off to the Sierra Club ceremony, Mr. Soyinka.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm glad Hafsat is there. She can deal with most of these untruths. I just wish to respond to one thing which the information officer said earlier. He said the election was a nullity. Now, that's nonsense. The election was concluded. The results were being announced state by state, and a clear winner had emerged. All the results have been collated. They are in possession of organizations in Nigeria and all over the world. That election was a reality. It was Babangida who got this prostitute, Athan Zeribe, and his organization, the so-called Association for Better Nigeria, to go to an obscure little court with an obscure, specially selected magistrate, one Mrs. I've forgotten her name now, very junior, a rookie on the bench, went there to get an injunction to stop the results being announced. Now, this game was played ad nauseam by Babangida and is being played in the legal issue of Moshood Abiola
Babangida,
by Abacha.
Babangida, by the way, for people, was the predecessor to Sunny Abacha.
That's right. And it's the same kind of game, the same misuse, the same trivialization of the judiciary that is being played by Abacha to stall the release of Abiola to ensure that he stays there indefinitely. Abacha has spoken to numbers of diplomats, intercessors, including African heads of state, and he has said very, very clearly to them, and they can be, you know, they can authenticate this, that Abiola was going to stay in prison. He's written it. I've seen a letter which he wrote to Mandela, for instance. I've seen his communication with a number of other African heads of state, some of them insolent in tone, virtually saying, listen, mind your own business. You also had a problem in your country not so long ago. So Abacha is just an international pariah. To suggest that it is Abiola or his lawyers or his family who've stalled his detention is just to be cynical.
Before you leave, Wale Soyinka, what about your own situation? In the billboard of the show, I talked about how you have a death threat hanging over your head. What is that situation? And then we'll get the Chief Information Officer of Nigeria, of the consulate here, to respond.
Well, I'm accused of being behind the bombings in Nigeria. No evidence has been adduced.
These are bombings of military places?
Of military targets. Abacha gave an interview to Washington Post, for which, in fact, I've tried to sue him in this country because it's absolute libel, in which he declared categorically. Can you imagine a head of state giving an interview to an international journal and accusing a citizen of a crime without any proof, you know, without it being placed even on trial in absentia? And I wish to say,
where were you at the time?
I was, I think, in the States, yes, when this came out. And I was accused, by the way, of holding a meeting. I think your listeners might like to hear this, just to show the level of credibility that can be given to Abacha and his spokespeople all over the world. I was accused of having publicly by one of his, I think it was Wada Nass, one of his ministers for special affairs, categorically of having attended a meeting in the Republic of Benin with trade union leaders, student leaders, etc., where we finalized plans to overthrow Abacha's government. Now, a date was given, a place, a location specific was given, and it so happened that on that day, I was in Scandinavia, attending a meeting in Davos, Switzerland, with witnesses such as Isaac Rabin, the Secretary General of the United Nations, Queen Isabella of Sweden, Bill Gates, the Microsoft. In other words, O.J. Simpson couldn't have had a better alibi than I had on that day. And here is a responsible minister of Abacha accusing me of attending a meeting in Farup, Republic of Benin. Now, it shows the caliber of people you're talking to, whose representative is right now in your studio. Not one jot of credibility is to be given to anything which any of them says.
Mr. Emmanuel Agbegi, your response?
Yeah, well, the likes of Soyinka have a right to say what they're saying, but
what about that specific point that when he was accused of being at this meeting in Benin, he was in Davos, Switzerland?
Well, I'm sure not everyone can locate him at any point, you know.
But that is a very public place that he was at with all of these world leaders.
Well, he can call on them now to testify on his behalf. After all, he's been asked to go back and defend himself. Right? It is a legal process.
Mr. Schwenker, why don't you return?
Yeah, when you're accused, let him go back and defend himself. He has advocated terrorism. He has said he supports anything, any violence that will bring down the government. And violence means terrorism. He said it on BBC. He did not deny it. I mean, he has not denied it. He has even gone to the extent of expunging certain sections of his book now, which advocated terrorism against the Nigerian government. Well, I don't know why he did what he did. But then, I mean, how? What were the circumstances under which he left the country? He said he slipped out. Nobody, I mean, was after him, but he said he slipped out. So how are we sure that he was where he said he was? Let him, as those people, at least can testify if he really was there.
Mr. Shoyenko,
he can go back and defend himself.
Why did you slip out of
the country? In any case, let me just get him to respond.
Why did you slip out of the country, and why won't you return for trial?
Because I do not recognize the authority of Abacha. Abacha cannot place me on trial. Instead, I'm placing Abacha on trial. We're going to hold a public tribunal for all his crimes against humanity in a few months. And let Abacha also come and defend himself, you know, because he is going on public trial. And we have a catalog. And we don't tell lies. We do our research very, very thoroughly. We know whom he has killed. We know all the secret murders, for instance, of about... don't forget, you know, there were... Abacha still has not responded to charges that he ordered the execution of some 73 officers, including mostly non-commissioned officers, in Lua Usman Dam on March 18th, I think, 1990, the year after I took over power. 1994.
I was in Abuja. Nothing like that happened.
No, yes.
I was in Abuja.
Nothing like that. We have categorical charges.
One at a time, please. You know,
we had categorical statements. The Financial Times journalist gave evidence. Olojede, a Nigerian journalist, gave evidence and located the burial spot. I mean, there are murders like this which have been committed by Abacha. And you all know this. This man is a monster. Let's face it. He's a mini Idi Amin. And he'll come to the same bad end.
Amy, may I speak about the legal processes?
Yes, and I want to thank Wole Soyinka for joining us. I do know that he has to leave. Wole Soyinka, again, he is the Nigerian Nobel laureate, and he is in this country. He says he will not return to Nigeria under the present regime of Sani Abacha, although they have charged him with treason. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Soyinka. Hafsat Abiola, you wanted to respond to some of what the chief information officer of the Nigerian consulate, Emmanuel Agbegi, had to say.
Right. I think the first thing I'd like to respond to is his comment about there cannot be two presidents in Nigeria at one time. Well, my father won 58% of 15 million votes.
How do you know?
Because it was called open balloting. There was a system of voting that was designed to ensure that there would be no cheating and that would be free and fair. So at the end of every at the end of the polling on the 12th of June, 1993, in front of all the people that were around, the people that were taking the votes of the people would have to count the votes aloud. The one box for one party, another box for another party, count how many votes in the different boxes before all the international monitors, including the United Nations, the Commonwealth, the Canadian government, the U.S. government, the British government, local monitors, including the Nigerian Bar Association, journalistic institutions, would have to count the votes before all these bodies and announce the vote. Then the votes would be announced on every local radio so that by the end of the day, we already knew what those votes were. All we were waiting for was the official announcement of the votes from each state, which was going on. And I think when it had reached maybe the 15th state of 30, the Nigerian military stopped announcing because all of a sudden it was clear that Moshood Abiola had won. This is a man that they cannot control. He won the 58% of 15 million votes. General Abacha has not had one vote cast for him. If you to choose between Moshood Abiola and General Abacha, who clearly is the president of Nigeria? And that's one thing. The other point was our gentleman's emphasis on the legal process in Nigeria. Well, maybe he can argue that my father's lawyers have delayed his case because, of course, my father's lawyers have faced constant harassment from the Nigerian military and obstructions in the course of proceeding with this case. And so then as this lawyer struggled to address the new obstacles placed before them by the Nigerian military will say, see, they're delaying the case. Maybe you could argue that. But then all the courts have asked that my father be allowed to see his family, his lawyers and doctors. The last time I saw my father was December 1995. He had been in jail since June 1994. The last time my mother was allowed to see him was September 1995 because she was being punished for our outspokenness, for our demand for democracy. So my family members were not allowed to see him. Doctors were not allowed to see him. Lawyers have not been allowed to see him since January of 1996. Then the last time a doctor was allowed to see him was in May, actually 3 months before the June 1997, and this came from pressure from Congressman Rangel of New York. So the Nigerian
Charles
military,
Rangel.
Yes, the Nigerian military has been denying access, even though the court said so. What does this say for the legal process in Nigeria?
Well, yeah. Mr. Emmanuel Agbegi, let's start with why Hafsat Abiola herself cannot see her father.
Why she cannot see her father? Well, I don't know how many times she's made attempts to see him, so
several,
I cannot.
Several
times. I mean, she's here in America saying that she's not in Nigeria. In any case, I don't know how much she knows about what went on, because all I can say is that I see her as one of the pampered kids who was here attending an Ivy League institution, which is not available to so many of us Nigerians.
Which is and not here my, she, that's
and
not
she,
my fault.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying, well, listen, let me say something.
Schools.
Yeah, she says it's not her fault because her father, a benefactor of all governments, military and civilian in Nigeria, was able to garner resources from the system and send her here. He has publicly acknowledged overthrowing a democratic government in Nigeria.
You're not addressing the question.
Yeah, well, I'm addressing it.
Why am I not allowed to see my father?
Because you're here in America. You cannot be in the United States
and
see your father in Nigeria. People see him. His doctors see him.
That's a lie.
Nobody has said he is incapacitated in any way.
Oh, my goodness.
Babangida, who annulled the elections, is his bosom friend. He wrote a letter to him just 2 years ago, what can be considered a love letter, asking that they should forgive and forget and become friends once again. I mean, so these things are all there. The evidences are there. The letters are there. Nobody has stopped her from seeing her father. She hasn't been there. In any case, there is a democratic process on course. We've had the first round of elections, local council elections. They were successful. People from the same zone, southwest part of the country, the minuscule minority that is making noise all over the place and seem to be drowning everybody with tissues of lies, participated. We're going to have State Assembly elections in December this year. We're going to have National Assembly elections in April in 1998. October, come August 1, 1998, we'll have governorship and presidential elections
before
and the handover. There'll be a handover.
Before we get
so
Hafsat
why don't we move forward instead of...
Yeah. Before we get Hafsat Abiola to respond to these various sets of elections, I wanted to ask you, Mr. Agbegi, yeah, what would it mean if the street on which the Nigerian consulate is... What would it mean for you if it was called a Kudirat Street?
Yeah, well, I think, it means a lot because it's like trying to put a wedge between the people of New York and Nigerians, because this is not a majority opinion. It is just people from, a particular ethnic group who just whip up certain sentiments and then just go all over the place trying to make it look like it's a majority opinion. I mean, it is going to put in a wedge between New Yorkers and Nigerians.
In your campaign,
because,
let me just ask something. Yeah. In your campaign to make sure that street is not named after Kudirat Abiola, yeah, do you have the support of, say, multinational organizations, say, like Shell Oil?
Well, we've not taken the issue that far. I mean, we think it is something we should be able to deal with. And we think that we're dealing with people who are civilized and who know what democracy means. In any case, this whole thing started in a rather very funny manner. We were not told. People just went before the community board and lied that the representatives of the Nigerian mission were there. So they presented their case, a one-sided case. There was no representation from the other side. The board just heard it and went ahead and took a decision. Now, when we got to know, somehow, by luck, because the whole thing was, I don't want to use the word fraud, but, that's almost what it looks like. We got to know. We went before the same board. The same board now said, if this is the case, we're now voting to put the motion on hold. We're going to rehear this issue in October. So all we have been trying to ask the City Council to do is to defer hearing on this issue, since the same board that originally began the issue has now reversed itself and said they were now willing to hear from both sides. So that's what we've been appealing to the Council. But if they're going to go ahead, well, we have made our representations and we're still going to make our representations. And we believe that these are highly honorable men who are going to know what is just and fair I mean, we think if the whole thing is about democracy, we don't enjoy people coming here to lie. We've had cases, even Amnesty International was forced to apologize because they were suckered in by Nigerians who come here and make claims of political persecution. So,
Mr. Agbaji, we have to make a break, and I do want to give Hafsat Abiola one last chance to respond before you both leave. After that, we'll be joined by British Labour parliamentarian Tony Benn and Bernadette Devlin-McCalliskey, Irish human rights activists. But we do have to break, and I want to thank you both for being with us. Wole Soyinka has already left, the Nigerian Nobel laureate. He will be coming to New York later today to testify at the New York City Council hearings. But when we come back, one last word from Hafsat Abiola. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we wrap up our conversation on Nigeria, talking about what's going on in Nigeria and also efforts around this country dealing with Nigeria. Hafsat Abiola, the daughter of Mashoud and Kudirat Abiola here in this country, Mashoud Abiola in prison for the last, more than 3 years after running for president in Nigeria. Hafsat's mother, Kudirat Abiola, gunned down in the streets of Lagos 2 years ago. Hafsat, can you sum up for us, if you want to respond to Mr. Agbaji, a chief information officer of the Nigerian UN mission here in New York, and also what is happening in Congress, because in the last 2 days, there have been what's called the Nigeria Advocacy Days, where people have been lobbying Congress members.
I really don't think that I have enough time, nor do I really have the inclination to respond to Mr. Agbaji. As you begin to study the Nigerian military, you will see that, like other oppressive regimes, they will seek to hide their violence with a lot of lies. You can peel through the lies. They're very clear. They're not even worth the effort. But in around the U.S., people that understand freedom and understand that solidarity is important to achieve freedom in Nigeria, as solidarity from the French people was important for Americans to achieve their freedom, are offering assistance. We have 6 cities so far that have passed resolutions and sanction bills, which means that they will not do business with the Nigerian military. Among the cities are Cambridge, Amherst, Oakland, Berkeley. All the cities, as you will see, if you see the names Cambridge, Amherst, these are places where you have your schools, where people can do research and can verify the things that I present them. And these cities have come up and said, no, they will no longer do business with the Nigerian military because they want their communities to be tyranny-free zones for the Nigerian people. That is very important to me. New York City has done so much in the past. They've condemned the military's resistance to democracy. They condemned the murder of my mother. And it is my hope today that they will name the street after my mother. My mother's name, Kudra, means power and wealth. In Nigeria, we're the 10th poorest country in the world because of the military, which has ruled for 26 of 36 years. But by my mother's actions, an ordinary woman that had the courage to stand up and speak for the people of my country because she had faith in the people of Nigeria and in the international community's love for humanity. Because of these actions by this woman, she signaled to the world and to the Nigerian people, she's validated the people of Nigeria and signaled that the power of my country, the wealth of its of my country, lie in its people. This is something that the Nigerian military will have to learn. But you see, I'm not going to waste my time to try to encourage them there. I just look to build our own army that will speak for us and work with us to achieve democracy.
And what's happening in Congress?
In Congress, they have a bill called the Nigeria Democracy Act, introduced by Donald Payne of New Jersey, Congressman Donald Payne. And so far, it has about, I think, 40 Congress representatives that have signed on to it. In the last 2 days, we had people coming from four cities around the U.S. and many people from within the D.C. metropolitan area going into the congressional house. Two houses, speaking to their representatives, lobbying for them to sign on to that bill. We're also trying to build support through other means around the country because we want that bill to pass.
Would the bill include a boycott of all Nigerian goods? I mean, that's very serious if you're talking about Nigerian oil.
Primary good being oil, but the bill does not include that language. And yet, if this bill passes, it will be the strongest statement made thus far by the Clinton administration, because so far it's just been vocal condemnations. We need them to take a significant and, you know, substantive stand behind the people of Nigeria. So it's still worth the effort to lobby.
Well, that is if they want to ignore the majority.
And how do you know that your military, institution of 100,000 in a country of 100 million represents a majority? Please.
On that note, we do have to wrap up because we have the British Labour parliamentarian Tony Benn waiting on the line. I want to thank you for joining us, Hafsat Abiola, again, daughter of Mashoud and Kudirat Abiola. Kudirat is no longer with us. She was gunned down 2 years ago. Mashoud Abiola in a Nigerian jail for the last few years. Emmanuel Agbegi, thank you for being with us, Chief Information Officer of the Nigerian Mission to the United Nations. Both will be today, along with Wole Soyinka and many others, and the New York City Council Chambers testifying about whether the street that the Nigerian UN mission sits on will be renamed in honor of Kudirat Abiola. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Some they follow them, close them eye. Some they follow them, close them mouth. Some they follow them, close them ear.
That music from the great Nigerian musician Fela. Well, we're going to move to another international issue. Peace talks between Britain and Irish Republicans began this week in Northern Ireland, but yesterday a bomb exploded at a police station outside Belfast, a blast which, if nothing else, highlighted the problems that lay ahead in any bid to bring a negotiated solution to the political crisis in Northern Ireland. There was no claim of responsibility for the bomb. The peace talks were revived earlier this year with the election of a new Labour government in London and a new ceasefire by the Irish Republican Army this summer. The IRA is fighting for the six counties of Northern Ireland to be reunited with the rest of Ireland. The talks, which are being mediated by former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, involve the Irish and British governments and Sinn Féin, the political representative of the IRA. The largest political party in Northern Ireland, the pro-British Ulster Unionists, led by David Trimble, has thus far stayed away from the negotiating table. Joining us right now to talk about his views on what's going on, and we're going to touch on some other issues as well, is Tony Benn, a member of Parliament in the ruling Labour Party. He has been there, I believe, for about half a century. Is that right?
Nearly, 1950.
Well, congratulations for that. What about your response to these latest developments, the bombing yesterday, but the peace talks overall, from your British perspective?
Well, it's not so much a British perspective as my own perspective, and I've always been in favour of the Irish cause. But I think it is a remarkable thing that after the setback 2 or 3 years ago, when the first ceasefire was called and the then Conservative government refused to talk to Sinn Féin or invite them to all-party talks, that although there was actually further bombing during the election campaign that wasn't very helpful, ceasefire was reintroduced. Sinn Féin leaders, Adams and McGuinness, whom I know very well, of course, have now confirmed the so-called Mitchell principles of a commitment to non-violence. And on that basis, the British government, new Labour government, did start the all-party talks on Monday. The problem then arose, would the unionists come? Now, Ian Paisley, the so-called democratic unionist, said he wouldn't, who wouldn't under any circumstances talk to Sinn Féin. But the biggest party, the Ulster Unionists under David Trimble, said they'd think about it. And a few hours ago, we heard that they have entered the building. I don't think that means a lot more than the fact that they have not refused to attend. And the bomb yesterday was, of course, designed to wreck the talks. Now, the IRA said it had nothing to do with them, and they always give a coded message. I have no reason whatever to believe that they would want to do that anyway. And security forces say there's a new organization called the Continuity Army Council, which I've never heard of. Some people even suspect that those who just wanted to wreck the talks from the other side might have played a part. I don't know whether that could be true. But fortunately, the British government have stuck to the view that Sinn Féin are committed, as they clearly are, to discussions. And I think the unionists will, in the end, or most of them, the major group, will be required to come because there's such a huge desire in the six counties for an end to the violence and for peace. So that's the way I see it at the moment.
British parliamentarian Tony Benn, we've just been joined by Bernadette Devlin-McCallisky, a leading human rights campaigner and Republican activist. Let's get your view of what's going on right now, the bombing yesterday, but the overall peace process that's happening that Sinn Féin is now being allowed to participate in. And it looks like, at least according to what Mr. Benn is saying, the pro-British Ulster Unionists, led by David Trimble, may have some role.
Well, I think they'll have a very key role. I was able to join you there a few moments ago and picked up the end of Mr. Benn's analysis of the bombing, and I think he's totally correct in that. I think there is, absolutely no evidence to indicate that it is the work of the IRA, and certainly no evidence to indicate any intention or desire on the part of the IRA to break their existing ceasefire. There are other elements, both within the Republican Unionist and indeed within the British military intelligence community, who would all be opposed to the present train of events, and all have an interest in events yesterday. And of course, nobody has any information as yet as to who did carry out the bombing. But I think that the overwhelming weight of evidence at every level would suggest that it was not the IRA and that its intention was, as it were, to make the present process more difficult.
You know, I have a question about British royalty, since they've been so much in the news since the death of Princess Diana. I'd like to ask Bernadette McCallisky and then Tony Benn, what has been the role of royalty in this whole conflict?
I would imagine, I don't know how Mr. Benn feels about it, I consider the role of royalty in any aspect of my life to be zero. I don't know these people, and their impact on my day-to-day living is very little, other than I'm aware that a great deal of the public taxes go to keeping them. They're not actually a family I spend a great deal of my time discussing. I don't think they have a political input into the matter at all.
British.
We'll have difficulty finding it on the map.
Labour parliamentarian Tony Benn.
Well, I'm a Republican. I'm in favour of us electing the head of state ourselves, as they do in the Republic. Mary Robinson is president of the Irish Republic, and I think that's the right way of doing it. In some ways, Britain is the last colony left in the British Empire. Everybody else has got free, starting with the United States, and we're left. But it's not really about the family. It's about an institution, a legal institution known as the Crown. Now, the Crown, quite apart from the royal family, has enormous power. Using what are called Crown prerogatives or Crown powers, any British Prime Minister can go to war without consulting Parliament, sign treaties without consulting Parliament, make laws in Brussels through the European Union without consulting Parliament, appoint bishops, archbishops, judges, members of the House of Lords, commissioners in Brussels. And so the Crown is a very powerful political instrument. A British Prime Minister has far more power in Britain than an American president has, where you've got checks and balances. But there is one other aspect of it that has some bearing on the situation in the six counties, namely that the unionists use the Crown to protect their own special position. I don't know how long it will be before Irish unity comes about, because I don't think the Republic wants to compel a reluctant six counties in, and I think the Sinn Féin are realistic that that can't happen at once. But I do think that the end of British jurisdiction in Northern Ireland i.e. the end of the claim by the Crown to govern Northern Ireland, is something that will happen. Meanwhile, I think what will occur for us out of the talks is a new settlement in which Dublin and London play a larger part, and ultimately there will be some settlement which leads to the withdrawal of Britain, because there isn't an Irish problem in the United Kingdom. There's a British problem in Ireland, and I've always seen it that way.
Bernadette Devlin-McCallisky, what would you like to see come out of these negotiations? And I want to ask how your daughter, Roisin McCallisky, is doing, for whom there was a very big campaign in the United States to free her from prison. She was pregnant there and charged by the British with terrorism.
Well, again, just I would endorse everything that Mr. Ben has said in terms of understanding the impact of the institution of the Crown on Irish politics as opposed to the royal family. I don't believe that this settlement, and I think that the major organisations who are party to the discussions are all in agreement, some of them not maybe publicly, that the question of the withdrawal of British jurisdiction and the return of the land from the Crown is not on the even intermediate future. Albert Reynolds, who was one of the chief architects of this process, said at a minimal it would be 25 to 30 years. The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has said he does not expect to see in the course of his lifetime a change within the partitionist settlement of Ireland and whatever. So I think that realistically, notwithstanding the fact that Sinn Féin believe they will see a united Ireland in their lifetime, when you get away from all of those semantics, the truth of the matter is that the people of Northern Ireland are approaching once again discussions around the settlement proposed by the British government of 1972. That was a power-sharing assembly within a northern state, which remained within the UK. The view of the people to be taken every 15, 20 years on that issue, and then the issue to be left, and some more modern interaction between the sovereign state of the Irish Republic and the north of Ireland within the British jurisdiction on matters of mutual interest like tourism, trade, or whatever.
Bernadette?
That has put the people in 72. I think they will finally settle for that in 97.
Bernadette, unfortunately, we don't have a great line to you, but we never seem to, speaking to you in Northern Ireland, and you say it's because it's more than Ireland.
It has to do with the fact that you share it with the police.
Well, I'm glad we can hear what we can from you, but just a quick update. We do have to go on your daughter, Roisin.
Well, Roisin's case comes up again on the 30th of September for hearing in the Magistrates Court, and we expect an extradition order to be served on her at that stage, and then she will have an opportunity to appeal to the Secretary of State.
Is she
so
with?
That case is still ongoing. She remains in hospital and will not be in attendance herself at the end of the month, but we have decided to at least initiate the proceedings without her because this could go on forever.
And Tony Benn, a British Labour parliamentarian, we have 30 seconds, but isn't it true that you introduced the legislation to abolish the royal family in Britain?
I did, and I've supported Bernadette, whom I've known since she was a Member of Parliament.
That's right.
I supported her in the case of her daughter. I think the Unionists in Northern Ireland really want to keep the British there, so if they maintain their privileges and repress the nationalist community, they can always rely on British troops. And I agree with what Bernadette said. The interim will be some new settlement, some assembly, and in effect Dublin and London sharing the overall responsibility for seeing it's policed. And that's a huge gain on what we've had so far.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Bernadette Devlin-McCallisky, former member of the British Parliament, leading human rights campaigner in Northern Ireland, and Tony Benn, a member of the British Parliament from the Labour Party in Parliament for almost half a century. He also introduced legislation for that complete landmine ban, and those negotiations have been taking place in Oslo, Norway. Well, you've been listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland engineered from New York. Andy York engineered from Washington. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Tomorrow, a special on the 50th anniversary of the CIA. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.